Tonight on Arena, Tressa O'Brien on her new film Town of Strangers and Sue Rainsford on her new novel Redder Days. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. See the world in one small town is a tagline for Town of Strangers, a film by Tressa O'Brien. The town in question is Gort in County Galway, and the film introduces us to a cross-section of people who've made new lives for themselves in the County Galway town. I'm delighted to welcome director Tressa O'Brien to the programme this evening. Gort, it's no stranger to new faces, particularly this County Galway town. You've unearthed a couple of very interesting statistics about Gort. But who are the strangers in this Town of Strangers film of yours, Tressa?
Hi, Sean. I'm absolutely delighted to be on the show. You've been a great friend to me during lockdown. So I came to Gort. I knew about Gort, and I started writing a film. And I heard about the meat factories in Gort, and it was a coming of age story of two young women. And I started to imagine that I might set it in Gort, and I went to visit it a few times. And as I was visiting and researching, I found out that it was the town at that time, the town worst hit by austerity. What a statistic. And the town with one of the highest and different kinds of nationalities in it relative to its population, which is just under 3,000. And this kind of fascinated me as kind of two Irish, big Irish stories colliding, that of our emigration changing to immigration and I guess our boom and bust. And, you know, I felt like there's a lot of things that I could explore starting with this town. And it also has a bit of, Gort has a bit of magic about it that I can't quite explain rationally or statistically, but it drew me in.
Well, all the counties, all the Galwegians and county people in Galway will agree with the magic of Gort, I'm quite sure, with you on that particular. Maybe the Tour Ballylee, which isn't too far away, Yeats's famous tower, maybe casts a certain magic spell around that particular area, perhaps. It is very interesting that Gort in and of itself has so many different nationalities represented in its immigrant population. And you go back, not just in a recent wave of emigration, but there was a kind of a hippie, not a hippie colony, but a group of hippies from England who made their way there before this more recent influx.
Yes, it seems to have attracted people, partly because you could get lost there. You know, on IMDb, I've listed Town of Strangers as a documentary, and I've also listed it as a Western. There's like these tick boxes you can tick. And in a way it is, or in its unconscious in some way, it has that still that Wild West feeling. And I guess in my imagination, or in the imagination of people who have come here in the last decades, the New Age travellers, and then in the last decade or two decades now, there was a lot of Brazilian people that came to live in the town. But I suppose that the town or the film is not only about that. I've settled on a kind of a clumsy enough term called hybrid cultural identities. So there are people that are born and bred in the town. For example, Chloe Donovan, who is an Irish traveller, and her family go back generations, obviously, here in Ireland. And there's myself, an Irish woman, and I count myself as one of the strangers in the town. So it's kind of... I sometimes describe the film as it's about people who are kind of have got longing and belonging. So we're belonging somewhere, and we're also longing for some other part of us that we're trying to connect with.
Interestingly, the film opens with yourself driving around in a van with a megaphone, almost like electioneering in some ways. But you're looking for people to audition for a film, is the way that you're putting it. Want to be in a film, then come to these auditions, which are held in one of the local halls on a Saturday in September, a couple of years ago now, it must be at this stage, before there was any talk of lockdown, because nobody had to be socially distanced in any of your auditions or anything like that. Did you just start out with that audition concept, Tressa, or how did it develop from there?
Well, as I mentioned, I was there trying to write or starting this fiction script. But when I went there, you know, truth is stranger than fiction and all of that. In my one of the versions of my script, I had a meat factory that was burnt down by one of the workers that I had shown to a script editor and a producer. And they were like, well, that's outlandish and that's too much. And I went to Gort and something like that had happened. A mysterious fire had burnt down one of the meat factories and nobody knew how it happened. And so it kind of started drawing me in, but I was quite interested in working with non-actors and operating in a space between or beyond documentary or fiction. I guess I see documentary not as a genre, but there's many genres within it. And I'd be quite inspired by and influenced by a lot of Iranian filmmakers who would make quite poetic work that isn't fiction nor documentary, and people acting as themselves in it. And it's kind of another zone. And I was quite interested in those auditions. I asked people to tell me dreams, lies, memories and gossip.
What more could you want than those three things? Four things, isn't it?
I could have added jokes, but they're things that operate also. They're neither fact nor fiction either, those dreams, lies, memories and gossip. So I'm kind of interested in the stories that we tell ourselves about ourselves and how we fictionalise our own truths. But they do remain truths, even if we sort of fabulate as we tell them.
Well, you mentioned the meat factories there and one of the early contributors that we get. And the nature of this audition, I'm calling it an audition, it's not quite like that. You all, the people sit down, the subjects sit down on a chair in front of your camera, and the camera's set up very clearly. You know, you're clearly making a film at this point and doing more than just auditioning people, and you ask them to tell their story to the camera. Tell me a little bit about Rosa, who works in a local meat factory in Gort, and then I'll play a clip from her.
Yes, so the people came to the auditions, and I didn't have a clear idea of what I was doing. I did put on it to tell me those things and so on, but I was very moved and surprised by the things that people told me and how they presented themselves and how they used that audition space actually to tell me things about themselves that I wasn't expecting, and that they set the film off on the journey that it went on in the end, that kind of came from those auditions.
Let's listen to Rosa then. Rosa is a Brazilian immigrant, and she speaks about being parted from her daughter for 10 years.
Yeah, first when I came to Ireland, my dream was to come here, stay for a year, and go home, have my pizza place. That's what I was used to dream about. Buy my own house and live with my daughter. But things didn't happen this way. But we are 10 years apart. When I came, she was only 8. And when we got together again, she was 18 years old. And in the beginning, seeing her photos, or, you know, I miss her so much that I used to turn the pictures. I didn't want to see her because it was hard to see. So I used to push upside down the frame, photo frame.
And that's Rosa from the film Town of Strangers, rather. Tras O'Brien, the director, is speaking with me this evening. Her story is quite extraordinary, how it unfolds, and you tease us with little bits of it. We don't get it all in one go, Trasa. I mean, this separation that she speaks of from her daughter, it is extraordinary how she describes it.
Yes, and Rosa is such a strong character as a person. She speaks so matter-of-factly, you know, about it, because she's gone through her own process, I think, of kind of dealing with that, and has been very happily reunited in Gort with Mary, her daughter, and has become a grandmother since making the film. So there's three generations of that Brazilian family in Gort now, and Rosa's only in her 40s.
Yeah,
because she had Mary when she was very young.
Yeah.
And she speaks of a recurring dream that she has, where she's in the army trying to protect a child. And so it's, I suppose, that this kind of that story or that unconscious is how she feels, I guess, about that separation from Mary. And I was really taken with her unconscious as well as her conscious testimonial.
You're not from Gort yourself now. As you've said, you've lived in several places around the country, I think, Trasa. But did you find a challenge being accepted into Gort itself?
No, I would. Gort, really, like, Gort is a fabulous town. It obviously lockdown has changed things a lot for the kind of sociability you can have, but it has four fantastic charity shops. Two of them, which give you biscuits and tea in the back of it, and that's where you can meet everybody. And that's where I did a lot of my research and talking to people and finding out things about the town and kind of my informal casting and talking about how I would do it. I spent about 4 months in Gort living there, and I lived with local people, including Anna, who's in the film, so it was quite an embedded research. And I did the auditions at the end of those 4 months, and then I kept making the film for another 2 years. So it was a very kind of intense and embedded process. And I met loads of people in Gort and lived in a few different places, including in my van, all around the town and in the environs. And people have really come behind the film as well. So while I was making it, but also since I've made it, we've had two, before the lockdown, we had two community screenings with the Gort Vibe Cinema Club and in the local hotel with the Gort Resource Centre. And they've all been, I've had such support for the film and what I've been doing without people really knowing what I was doing as I was doing it. I didn't know what I was doing sometimes, which I also talk about in the film in a sort of radio show way, which you might have enjoyed, Sean.
Is that an actual radio station, or were you setting us up there, or does that give away the magic?
I can't be saying
that. Fair enough. Yes, I accept that totally. You let people watch.
That answer says it all.
Yeah, let people watch and decide for themselves. You mentioned here, it's not only the people who have come to Gort in recent years, but people who have been there for years. And Chloe Donovan, you mentioned, a young woman from a traveller family in the area who doesn't want to leave Gort. It was interesting to hear that side of the story as well, not just people who wanted to get away from where they were born and brought up or had to get away to make a new life from. It was interesting to get the, no, I don't want to leave here.
Yeah, so Chloe is like 17 at the time of filming, and is like she's a fabulous person, and she's just full of potential, as anyone is at that age. Whereas Rosa, who we've heard, has a story behind her, if you like. And with Chloe, it's like, she's so magnetic on the screen, and it's like you feel that you can pour anything you like into her life. It's all ahead of her what's going to happen. And she is, it's not that she doesn't want to leave Gort. She expresses a kind of a fear around leaving.
Yes.
She's got a very tight-knit, close family and community, and that's a really safe thing. So, but she's curious, but she's not sure how to leave or who's gone before her, you know? As part of the film, we went to see a fortune teller who she told me about, who lived over the road in Loughrea, who was absolutely fab. And I got my own fortune told that day as well. And I think we're going to hear a clip from that.
Yeah, well, let's hear Chloe getting her fortune told, as you say.
So the cards are telling them all. Like this one, now you have a broken heart. The person that they love, if you end up with him, he's going to break your heart.
Yeah.
He's very bad background. All fight. This fella, he's a quiet ground, the dark-haired man. Very, very good. And you will be married, but I don't know when. That's up to yourself. And don't let this fella fool you. He tell you he love you. And this and that, he don't love you. He make a fool out of you if you could get sick of you. And he get up and he'd leave you there. What age are you now, Chloe?
18.
Time enough to marry. You could get married today, you could marry tomorrow. That's up to yourself. Why are you going to come and ask for you? And how your father and mother are going to take it?
I think my mother and father would be happy.
Yeah, your father and mother would be very happy, but not the first fella. Not the person you're going out with. He'd be happy with the dark-haired man.
Now, I don't know how much fortune tellers tell you what you want to hear, or they tell you what your parents want you to hear in the case of Chloe in that particular clip from Town of Strangers. But it's a lovely scene, and you get a real sense of how excited Chloe is there, Tressa O'Brien, director of the film, speaking to me, how excited she is just to hear, well, what might happen? What should I do? What can I do?
Yes, and I guess that's the we can all relate to that, can't we? I mean, there's every person that I kind of responded to in the audition, I felt drawn to, you know, and like without sounding too dramatic or romantic, I love each person in it, you know.
Yeah.
And I grew quite friendly with some of the people, some more than others. There's 8 or 9 people in the film, you know, but I became very close with Hamid, for example, and I'm quite close with Chloe and her extended family as well, who always give me a really warm welcome when I go to Gort.
I'll go to Hamid in a minute, but before I go there, I want to speak about a young woman called Elham. Where is Elham from originally? Yes, she's Syrian. Yeah, she is. She's Syrian, isn't she? And she's come over with her family. I mean, heartbreaking story. But what I really found interesting about this tale is you see Elham with is the man her husband, or certainly a relation of hers, and a young child. And just tell us the scene that he plays out in front of the young child and Elham.
So this is a scene that actually, I'll tell you about the scene, and I'll tell you a small bit about how we made it, because it's kind of interesting how we made it. But Ilham and her partner, Adel, tell the story of their boat crossing, which from Turkey to Greece, you know, the people know about the rubber dinghy boat crossing. I had spent myself actually on and off for making this film. I was working with in solidarity camps in Lesbos and in Greece and in Calais. So there's a kind of, you know, I would have witnessed a lot of these, and I was actually doing some of those boat rescues and boat meetings. So I had very kind of firsthand experience of this the crisis situation, we'll say. But it was also a joyous situation for people. So even though we hear obviously how awful it is, many people successfully get there and like kiss the ground and are weeping with joy for having made it. And I was kind of interested in the aftermath of that, because whether it's a joyous experience or a dramatic or a traumatic experience, it's bloody important to you and seminal in your life. And we did a whole workshop with Elam and Adele to work through these things with other people in Gort. And they tell the story to Habibi, who was 3 years old at the time. They tell the story to her as though it's a bedtime story. So they tell it in this soft spoken way. Adele begins with a lullaby, and together they tell her in Arabic the story of the crossing. But they tell it in this really gentle, sweet way, about this as a fairy tale kind of bedtime story. And it's just hugely moving, because we can feel, you know, there's so much more emotion to that.
Yeah, I mean, what's extraordinary is they play it out with a little Tupperware container, essentially, and little puppets in the container itself. It's so touching, and the little girl is watching all of it. And you wonder, did you get any sense of what she was absorbing as she watched and heard that story being told? I mean, it was her story that was being told to her.
I guess she felt the gentleness, you know, she felt the tone and the action. I mean, I'm not more than the words, I'm guessing. Because yeah. I, in some ways, because I don't speak Arabic, I have like kupla fokal Arabic, shwai shwai. But I was also only understanding the intonation and the way they were telling it. So I hadn't thought about that before, but I probably experienced in a similar-ish way than she did. But it was her parents, obviously. So that's a very close connection. Yeah. But it's a very intimate moment that we witness or share with them in the film.
Oh, the way he tells that story, it is absolutely beautiful, it has to be said. Another, the man then that stopped me in my tracks just towards the end of the film, we start to see. We've got a hint of him earlier on, because we keep getting shots of the local pizza and kebab shop. This is a man from Afghanistan called Hamid. A little bit of his background, if you would, before I want to play a clip where, as I say, he really did stop me in my tracks with his story.
Yeah, so I'm not sure which clip you're going to play, but Hamid's first thing that he says in the film, and one of the first things he ever said to me was, "I came from under the truck." Yeah. And those words have resounded in my head so much. So he arrived to Ireland from under a truck. So you can, you know, you have in a way that less is more with that, isn't it? In terms of what his journey. But he went through Calais and Greece, you know, where I had been before. So we kind of connected through that. But I had only put the poster up in his pizzeria the day before and had a chat with them and asked him to come to the audition. So it was later that I found out a lot more of his story as we became friends. And we filmed on and off for about 2 years. So, since, you know, I didn't film with him between the audition, and it was nearly a year before I filmed again, because I got to know him and, you know, I didn't want to push anything, because he was really showing a lot of vulnerability when he came to that audition. So I was kind of waiting to see, OK, is this the right thing to do with him? Because he expresses a very deep loneliness and also fear.
Well, it's that loneliness. In fact, that's the clip that I want to finish up with. But I'll say goodbye to you, and we'll finish up with that clip. Congratulations on the film, Trasa. It really is. There's something. It really wound me in as I watched it over the hour and 20 minutes. It went a very very quick hour and 21 minutes. So congratulations on that. And thanks for speaking with us. Lovely to speak with you.
That it's showing in the IFI, and that it's going to reach the wider audience, because obviously COVID scuppered it for a while.
Yeah, well, I'll give details. I'll give details to people of where they can get in the IFI. But let's finish with Hamid and his expression of just how difficult it is when you're trying to make a new life for yourself far from home.
Sometimes I'm very strong, very, very strong. I'd say I don't have any problem, I don't care anyone. I can do whatever I want. But sometimes it makes me very depressed. I just think, go kill yourself better. This is not life. Maybe feel lonely, that's why I feel to do it. But hopefully I'm not doing that.
No, don't do
this. Hopefully. It's sometimes very hard. I'm telling you, I'm very, very hard. Like, sometimes I go crying, can't. No one that right?
Okay,
fine. No one can. I need sometimes someone to talk. That's hard. It's a hard for me. It's very hard.
Hamid there telling his story to Tressa O'Brien, the voice that you heard in the background in that clip, she being the director of the film we were speaking about there, Town of Strangers. It's available to stream via IFI at Home service and it'll be available from March 19th. And some of you texting there to find out, to ask me to repeat the name of the film we were speaking about at the beginning of the programme this evening. Town of Strangers. Town of Strangers is the title of that film, directed by Tressa O'Brien. It will be available to stream via the IFI at Home service from March the 19th and ifi.ie. The Irish Film Institute's website will give you all of the details on how you can do that. Sue Rainsford's new book, Redder Days, is the tale of Anna and Adam, twins surviving in a world where climate disaster has set off contagion and caused humans and animals to mutate. This is Sue's second novel, her acclaimed debut, Follow Me to Ground, won her the Kate O'Brien Award in 2018. We last spoke to Sue in January when her short story, Shorn, read by Saoirse Ronan, was broadcast here on RT Radio 1 as part of the Spoken Story series. But I'm delighted to have Sue join us again on the programme this evening. Adam and Anna, they're in a commune that they were born into, as the book starts, so long since been abandoned by the mother. Give us a little of their circumstances, how we find them as Redder Days starts.
Hi, Sean. Thanks for having me back. Anna and Adam, they are living in this commune, rural isolation, and, you know, they're days are, well, Anna is awake during the night and Adam is awake during the day, and they sort of cross paths at dawn and dusk and try and protect themselves from this condition they refer to as red or redness while the world continues to deteriorate around them.
And as you say, one of them, Anna, awake at night and Adam awake all day. They're in a permanent state of watchfulness, really. There's a sense that disaster could arrive at any moment, certainly in their minds.
Yeah, I mean, that was something that was sort of a struggle in writing the book, was trying to figure out exactly the toll that constant watchfulness would take on the body and that sort of state of hypervigilance, which is something that we're obviously all quite familiar with now over the course of the last year. But yeah, they are constantly attuned to their environment and their surroundings.
It is extraordinary when you think of it. You know, you're writing about this contagion that causes people to isolate themselves, albeit this is a much more a post-apocalyptic type of scenario that Adam and Anna and those around them are experiencing. But this was all written before there was any talk of COVID, obviously. I mean, you don't suddenly get a novel together starting last year and have it printed and ready and published, you know, right now. You don't do that in the space of 12 months. When did the writing of Redder Days start, and when did it culminate in relation to the pandemic?
You know, it's almost uncanny, because I started, the initial kernel of it came to me, I suppose, in sort of 2013, 2014. And I was working on it on and off, you know, I was working on my first book as well. And then I sent the final manuscript to my editor sort of this time last year, March 14th. And for ages after I'd sent it and, you know, the restrictions were tightening up and lockdown was getting more severe, I felt that I'd maybe sent some sort of hex out into the world, because the book and daily life were lining up so thoroughly. But yeah, no, it is, like I say, it's uncanny.
There is something extraordinary about that. A few interviews, situations where books that, you know, seem as if they almost are predicting the state that we're currently in, or in your case, maybe predicting a much worse state further down the line for us. But the fact that, you know, that you're writing this at a time before all of the restrictions that we've been dealing with for the last year, how do you think that will change the way the book is received? It's impossible now to read it without that COVID-19 perspective somewhere in your mind. It's impossible to read it possibly in the way you wrote it and intended it to be read.
You know, I really hope so. I hope it can still be read as a work of fiction on its own terms. I mean, I think it's unavoidable that there are certain embodied experiences that I try to detail in the book, like, you know, like we're saying, isolation, curtailed movement, hypervigilance and watchfulness. I think it's unavoidable that those experiences will land more with the reader. And I think that could ultimately strengthen the reader's response. But yeah, I hope a lot of the other themes still come to the fore.
Yeah, because to me, yes, of course, the isolation and those things are, it's an important aspect of the book for sure, but it's not the kernel, it's not at the very heart of the book. There are other themes that came to the fore for me, not least of which is, I suppose we have to talk about cults and religion in terms of the character of Coan. Is that how I would say Coan's name, or how do you say it?
I say Cone, but I'd say you're actually pronouncing it correctly.
Well, he's your character after all, but let's go with yours then, Cohen. Explain the role, I suppose, that he's playing within the book, and the role that a kind of cultish, a fervent type of religious belief plays in the story of Adam and Anna.
You know, when I first started thinking about the book, really, I had quite a loose concept, which was this idea of two people living in the middle of nowhere following quite a strange set of rituals. And I was thinking a lot about how inherently strange so many of the religious practices that we grew up with in Catholic Ireland are, and, you know, how familiarity and tradition can breed a sort of nonchalance around what is objectively quite strange behavior. I'm like interested in how cults and ritual behavior, why and how that appeals to people, and how giving up your agency is actually quite appealing to a lot of people in a lot of circumstances. And I don't mean quote unquote damaged people. I mean all sorts of people. And I think, again, that's something that we can see even playing out now, this constant appeal to bodies other than ourselves, institutional or otherwise, for some sort of instruction, you know.
And do you think it's an abdication of personal responsibility to hand that instruction over to somebody else?
To a degree, yeah. Yeah, I do.
Explain that to me a little bit further. Is there a problem with somebody saying, well, look, I need some guidance, I need some moral guidance here, I need something, some kind of set of rules that I might feel I can apply to my life? Do you think that they should come always from within, or can they come from somewhere else?
Moral guidance, again, I think, you know, moral behaviour is, again, to me, such a funny fluctuating term, or I don't know if we can even have one definition of what is moral or amoral. I don't see any issue with people looking to entities or forces or institutions or groups bigger than themselves for instruction. But yeah, for me, it's like when those things sort of get into the nooks and crannies of your desires or your fantasies or your inner life and can feel admonishing or prescriptive in some way. That, for me, is when it starts to get problematic.
How important is it that Adam and Anna are twins?
Yeah, I mean, that to me, I wanted them to be twins because I wanted them to have the exact same start in life, if you know what I mean. I wanted them to come from the absolute baseline similar experience and to show and to kind of play around with nurture versus nature, I suppose. So, you know, you have these twins, they're born on the same day, the same hour, and yet their experience of the world they're living in is radically different, even though they've shared the same womb for all this time and their experiences are the same. But the way they interpret those experiences is, again, radically different.
But there is something beautiful in the way that I think it's Adam that speaks about this, the idea that they were one in the womb. But this contagion that is prevalent as the backdrop to the novel, twins are immune to it, or twins can survive without it. So he talks, I think, about they split, they were one in the womb, but they split into two so that they could survive. I found there was something quite idealistic about that. Are you a twin? Do you have a yearning for twins?
You know, I was actually a twin in utero, but my twin unfortunately didn't survive. So that is something, and again, I've kind of spoken a couple of times, touched loosely on these strange experiences I had in my adolescence of having this dream about a boy with my face and kind of being feeling visited by him during my dreams. And eventually, and then my parents told me, they're like, you know, actually you were a twin in utero. And yeah, I thought, again, it's sort of fascinating to think you would have this shared emotional life, you know, or this these shared experiences that maybe you're not cognizant of, but that live on at a somatic level.
Yeah, it certainly makes it that would make me read the twins very differently in the book, and knowing that it gives me a different angle on them for sure. Because my follow up question, had I you know, knowing that now, is doesn't have quite the same potency. This idea that I wondered how gender driven was the choices that they make, and the fact that you give us, you know, a girl and boy here as opposed to two girls or two boys for that matter.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose even with my first book, I was quite keen to sort of investigate how much of gender is a cultural construct, you know. So I was interested in having a boy and a girl to show that if you grow up outside of the template of Western society or patriarchal Western society, you know, what sticks and what falls away. So I suppose I wanted to keep the two conventional genders in there to sort to play with that dynamic.
And they do, because the novel is narrated essentially by the twins and Cohen. There are other narrators in there as well, but you know, those are the vital and very important ones, I think it's probably safe to say. Anna and Adam, they address us very differently. I don't know if you would agree with this analysis. Adam, in a slightly more direct, prosaic way, but Anna, Anna is very much in a world that is described physically and earthy. You know, you can feel it, you can smell it, you can taste it, you can touch the world that she's in. Hers is a much more visceral world, or viscerally described anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that viscerality, I suppose, if I could write, if every page I write could just be visceral content in the way that Anna sees the world, I'd be very happy. But I sort of have to thread through, like you say, more prosaic or more traditional direct passages as well, just so that the reader doesn't give up on page five. But yeah, I think, you know, that for me, I'm very interested in specifically experiences of femininity and different experiences of the female body, which have that visceral component or that graphic component.
And how important a theme is regret then, which is another thing that I thought was important in the story. Perhaps you have to talk a little bit about motherhood before you talk about regret, possibly.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think a lot of the characters in the book, maybe not Anna and Adam themselves, but I think the other characters in the book are all grappling with some degree of regret. And I always knew I wanted to write about regret in relation to forgiveness. You know, I've always been interested in these narratives where we have regret as a sort of catalyst for a character, and it moves them forward towards redemption or salvation. But I wanted to think about, well, what if those things aren't an option? What if what you've done is unforgivable, or, you know, you've just run out of time and you just have to live in this state of regret or remorse? And, you know, what does that do to a traditional narrative arc then? And I suppose when I was thinking about regret and trying to write about it in that way, for me, that's really the only time I see myself as tackling climate change as a theme in any meaningful way, because I'm just haunted by this certainty that the full scope of our regret for the damage we've done to the planet will only actually come into play at the moment that it's too late, that we've gone beyond the point of action.
I suppose it is interesting in that respect that it is the older characters who express this regret. There are parents among those older characters, and obviously Cohen is one of the characters who I think expresses a little bit of some regret within that as well.
A little.
I think it's also Cohen who says quite early on in the book, "The planet thus distressed had found a new way to purge." I suppose this idea that Mother Nature, you know, Mother Nature will help the planet survive. Whatever species is getting in the way of the planet's survival, better watch out. Have you a sense of that being the reality of our situation? Hopefully not in the next week or two, but, you know, no. Possibly in the near future.
Yeah, I do, to a degree. I do see that as an interesting avenue to explore from a fictional point of view. Again, don't want to spend too much time focusing on it from a nonfiction point of view right now. But I think, you know, Cone, I think each of the characters who sort of have some earlier experience of the world as it existed prior to the lifetime of the twins, you know, they each have some sort of primary trauma that's causing them to interpret the world in a particular way and to interpret the ongoing changes in a particular way. So while that's very much Cone's reading of the situation, I don't see that as the only interpretation or the only true narrative.
Is misogyny alive and well in this post-apocalyptic world?
Misogyny is alive and well and thriving, yeah.
Even a pandemic can kill it, no?
No, unfortunately not. I mean, to the degree in which Cone is still exercising a degree of control over the twins and, you know, is still very much set in his belief system. But I think, you know, again, it was something I tried to portray in my first book, is that when you strip away different cultural layers, you know, again, this question of what sticks and what are we left with? And with that in mind, you know, Anna is pretty much left to her own devices during the day, and her experience of the world and her experience of her own body, I try to depict without too many misogynistic or chauvinistic templates bearing down on her. And it, like, similarly, you know, she is the stronger of the two twins, and her mother is incredibly strong. I've tried to pepper the book with strong and quote-unquote a-conventional women while also depicting the misogyny that they're in friction with.
One thing before we go, if I remember right, when I spoke to you back in January, wasn't it? Was it January? You were in Zimbabwe at that time, and I asked you, well, how long are you going to be there? And you said to me, well, I'm hoping I might get home in March because we're supposed to be getting married. What is this? I'm not speaking to you in Zimbabwe this evening, am I?
No, we are back in Dublin for this long-awaited, much-anticipated registry office adventure, which is all going to plan, still happening on Friday.
And can you only have a small number of people there without butting my nose in, but sticking my nose in anyway?
No, you're grand. Yeah, no, it's 8 of us overall. So myself and Connor, and then 6 guests. So we're keeping it pretty tight. Yeah. But we'll be able to have a few drinks.
Yeah, well, to those then who are saying, why wasn't I invited? Because she couldn't and Connor couldn't either. That's why you weren't invited. They were only allowed 6 other people. Well, listen, the very best. When is that, Sue? Sorry, Thursday, is it?
Friday afternoon.
Well, the very best of luck to both yourself and Connor for Friday afternoon.
Thanks so
and
much,
for
Sean.
For all the time ahead of you as well. That's Sue Rainsford, and Sue speaking to me about her latest novel, Redder Days, which is published by Doubleday. Edward Kennedy Ellington, better known by his musical moniker Duke Ellington, was born in 1899, would go on to be one of the most influential figures in jazz music throughout the 20th century. Beyond his musical legacy, he left an enormous statement in the American consciousness about African-American identity and culture. His musical output over a half a century career is vast. So it was quite a challenge for my guest, Jimmy Fay, Artistic Director of the Lyric Theatre in Belfast, to answer my favourite Tuesday night question. Where do I begin with? And in this case, where do I begin with Duke Ellington? You've taken up the challenge, Jimmy. Thank you for doing so. And you've selected some of his most iconic pieces of music. We'll try to get to most of them over the next 14, 15 minutes or so. How would you sum up, Jimmy, the importance of Duke Ellington to the development of jazz, particularly as an American art form?
Thanks, Sean, for having me on. The roots of jazz are blues, ragtime, spirituals, mostly from New Orleans, but throughout the country. It's a free music. It's improvisation. There's a huge, huge part of it still. It's a street folk arc. It's from the African-American experience. and became from the 20s to the 50s the most popular music in America. And the reason for this is, I think, reflected the growing confidence of the Americans from World War I onwards. They had amazing swing bands, which was like the first youth music. They had Count Basie, Benny Goodman, Louis Armstrong, Artie Shaw. Paul Whiteman was known as the King of Jazz, but the real king was definitely the Duke, right? Mm. Ellington, to my mind, exemplified the best. His music swung, but it was also introspective. It was popular, but it always played with form. He pushed the envelope, discovered new sounds, and he never, ever stopped creating. And he had a band that were completely loyal to him for almost 50 years.
Yeah, it was a band. That's the kind of the apocrypha. It's not apocrypha. The real story around Duke Ellington is this band that stuck together through thick and thin and through, mm-hmm. you know, as you say, half a century almost. Was there music in his background growing up in Washington, D.C. at the early years of the 20th century?
Well, interesting. He came from a middle class background in Washington. His dad was a butler. And his mum, Daisy, who he adored, she was on his pedestal for the whole of his life. She insisted he had piano lessons from a very young age, which he would skip from now and again and go back to. But she insisted that he practiced. And the thing is, he kept practicing, you know, all the time. So there wasn't music so much. I can't discover anything that he came from a kind of a musical heritage in that sense. But I think he just fell in love with the piano. It was a connection to his family. And I mean, he was clever as well. Like, I mean, he formed his first band when he was 17. He composed his first song. It was called Soda Fountain or something like that, because he was working there.
Soda Fountain Rag, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And he was a sign painter. And people would come and say, oh, can you put a sign up for this party we're having? He said, well, who's playing at the party? And he said he'd offer his services, you know, with his piano. And he'd go along and he'd play these joints. And he took off from there. And he was really kind of self-made in a way. He would go and study the orchestra at the cinema, because remember, it was silent cinema then. And in Washington, you had great orchestras in the cinema, and he would watch what they were doing. Then he'd go back to the juke point with his friends or his pals and try and imitate what they were doing.
So he was kind of imitating the orchestral sound with a number of instruments, which eventually would become the instruments of the big band. But when did the move come, Jimmy, from Washington then to New York? Because that's kind of going to be the bit where his career moves, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It was all taken off in New York. You know, kind of that ragtime had begun to grow into this kind of other kind of jazz that was taking off. And they thought that's where it's all happening. So him and his band first went there, I think, in 1920.
So are we talking about the Cotton Club even at that stage?
And then he got to the Cotton Club 27. He had a residency in the Cotton Club, and that's where he went into orbit. So he had like a 5-year residency in there, and he just was inundated with huge success. You know, he was a huge showman. He was able to kind of really go at it. Like, it was like what the Beatles did in Hamburg. He just never stopped. They were doing 7 nights a week, nonstop. So the Cotton Club was a big, big part of where his beginnings were.
1927, as you say, was when that took off. A year later then, he gave us this track. Go The Mooch, the title of that great, great title for a great track, 1928 from Duke Ellington. And Jimmy Fay is with us this evening answering that Tuesday night question, where do I begin with Duke Ellington? That's typical. That's the Duke Ellington sound, certainly of the early period, Jimmy.
Absolutely. That's Bubby Miley on the thing. He was able to use his the people who played his instruments, you know, brilliantly. Bubby Miley had his growl, his wah-wah, that was a bit kind of exotic, and he was just able to put in this tune. And the Mooch is a kind of slouchy kind of walk through Harlem. So Duke Ellington was always using the sounds of Harlem, and this is what he did his whole life. Not just Harlem, but all urban landscapes and places that he was. He was just able to put it into the music and made it really evocative. I think that's a beautiful track.
Was Billy Strayhorn part of the setup at this stage?
No, not in the 30s. I mean, he had a huge success from 27 to, say, 39. And then Strayhorn was a young guy from Pittsburgh that wrote to him and said, really, you know, he met him, I think, in Pittsburgh. So Duke Ellington wrote to him and he said, well, when you come to Harlem, take the A train and come up and see me. So So Strayhorn's big introduction into the band was he took Ellington's letter and he turned it into a song. And that became Take the A-Train.
Take the A-Train. Imagine turning up for an interview for a job with a song in your back pocket like that, Jimmy.
Well, it must have worked. It completely worked because Strayhorn stayed with him then for the rest of his life until the late 60s. And they were interchangeable. Like, I mean, that's what Ellington said about Strayhorn. He was his eyes, his ears, his soul, his stomach, not his ego. He loved Strayhorn. He absolutely... And it's only kind of recently we're beginning to see Strayhorn's importance to Ellington, you know, over the last 20 years or so.
And it's interesting what you say, though, there, that mention of ego, because it touches maybe on how the band managed to stay together. I mean, these were extraordinary musicians, Billy Strayhorn, just one of them.
Johnny Hodges, who was alto sax, who was just a genius at it. And, like, I mean, everybody tried to imitate him. Harry Carney, who stayed with for 50 years. He was with Ellington from Washington all the way till 1974, when they both died in the same year, actually. And then you had Ben Webster later on, tenor saxer as well, and Sonny Gear, drummer. These were extraordinary musicians who could have probably had a career by themselves. But they stayed with Ellington because he composed specifically for them. He made them part of the song. That's why Ellington's sound is, you know, you can't imitate it. It sounds, it was made for these extraordinary musicians. So the texture of it, the whole feeling of it, is what the Ellington effect is. Strayhorn knew exactly with this as well. That's why he was able to write so well for the band.
I want to play a little bit of Harlem Suite because I think it gives us a whole other side of it. You know, some of the musicians you mentioned there, you're talking about, you know, a whole mix of ethnic backgrounds. And he was able, Ellington was able to bring a mix of ethnic music almost into this jazz idiom. It starts out pretty straightforward, but then it goes somewhere else. I just wanted to let that little bit of clarinet establish itself, Jimmy, before I got you to talk about Harlem Suite. And it is that idea that he really does bring all these different musics into play, Duke Ellington.
Well, people talk about this with Ellington. He'd be going down the street, he hears some girls, you know, doing skipping rope, and he'd like the tune of it, and he'd put it into his music. And that, for example, is a portrait of Harlem. Mm. You know, Harlem, we obviously know, is an African-American area, but before that, it had been a Russian-Jewish area. So he puts a little tune of, like, Russian-Jewish kind of folk idiom just there, just in the middle of it. It's a long, that's about a 15-minute suite, and he pops it in there, and it passes by like the neighborhood's passing by, and how time evokes and how we go through life, you know. He's very evocative as a musician and as a composer.
I know I want to finish with something that I know you love, Jimmy, but before, which is Coco, okay? That's what I'm going to finish up with, because I know you want to hear that. We haven't got to the Anatomy of a Murder, the work for cinema. But what do you think Ellington's legacy is to the world of jazz? What did he give that all of those other big bands simply didn't give?
He gave a presence to this form that could have been just a popular kind of fad, and he turned it into an art form, I think, almost single-handedly. You had Benny Goodman, you had other people, but he was the example to people like Miles Davis and John Coltrane that there was a career and there was an expression of African-American thought to this. I think he was probably the greatest American composer of the 20th century, because I think he is still being imitated. He came from the Harlem Renaissance in the 20s. And this is what, like, this is why he is so powerful. He thought about what he was doing and he never stopped. He never, every moment, every hotel he went into, he had a piano put in there and he just kept going.
A little bit of Coco to finish up. Thanks for speaking to us this evening, Jimmy.
Thank you, Sean.
Super stuff indeed. Coco there from Duke Ellington, and it was Jimmy Fay, Artistic Director of the Lyric Theatre in Belfast, who was speaking to me about the career of Duke Ellington. Where do I begin with said Mr. Ellington. That is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Patha Kearney was on sound this evening, and the programme was produced by Sinead Egan. We have a special programme for you tomorrow. Law Specialta, Clar Specialta, we might say. Tola McKay and the Saw Doctors will be there. Gemma and Levy will be looking at some great Irish artists, and also others like Kazuo Ishiguro, who will talk to us about some great Irish artists. In his case, he'll be talking to us about Beckett Singh and Conor McPherson. That's what we'll have for you tomorrow, Law Éileadh Fáil.